It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll hear about the first superstar of Wisconsin college football and why he dropped out of the public eye after his days on the field in the 1890s.
First, two new bills aimed at clarifying the use of two police procedures have been introduced this week in the state legislature. The Republican-authored bills would require police departments to develop written policies on no-knock search warrants and track SWAT team deployments.
The bills come at a time when there's a lot of public attention on police practices. Some are asking questions, though, about how these bills would work and if they'd put too much pressure on law enforcement.
Here with us now to talk more about this legislation is Dean Knudsen. He's a Republican state representative from Hudson. Representative Knudsen, thanks for joining us.
Good to be with you.
Well, let's start with warrants. Now, one of the bills you're introducing would require Wisconsin police departments to develop written policies on when no-knock search warrants are used. Can you make the case for us for why you think this is needed?
I think it's important to increase transparency for citizens and for the agencies themselves, and as an important safeguard to preserve civil liberties. What happens is over the last 20 years approximately, things have changed. It used to be that to execute a warrant, the police always notified you of their presence and asked to come in. In the late 90s, the laws changed, and now the police can either seek permission from the judge at the time of getting the initial warrant to execute it without knocking and without announcing their presence, just coming in, or they cannot do that, but they can still, at the time of the execution of the warrant, they can make the decision on the spot to go in without knocking. And the problem is we ask questions like, how often is this happening? Is there an increase in the use of no-knock warrants? What's going on here in the state? And we really don't have data on that. So what our bill requires is two things. Create a policy. Every police agency should already have one. I think most of them probably already do. But create a written policy. And then report on an annual basis. How many warrants did you serve? Or did you execute? How often did you do that as a no-knock with permission from the judge? And how often did you do it as an audible and decide to do a no-knock on the scene? Simple reporting of that aggregate data once a year.
So I want to make sure I got you. You're saying that every police department individually would be responsible for their own written policy.
Correct. And so we're not inhibiting what they're doing. There's no restrictions or controls on what they would be doing. It's simply a matter of transparency. And we believe that they ought to have a policy anyway so that they have internal consistency within their department so that all the officers and all the different precincts across their city or municipality or jurisdiction, that everything is being done the same and citizens can be confident that it's being done for a sound reason.
Why is that sort of approach better than having one policy for the entire state of Wisconsin?
Well, I mean, since I introduced this yesterday, that's been a common response, is it makes so much sense to have a policy. Why wouldn't the legislature write a one-size-fits-all policy and dictate it down to the departments? I frankly prefer allowing them to have local control. I'm not sure one-size-fits-all, you know, works all the way from Milwaukee down to a small rural town or county. And so having their own policy and having the ability to work that out internally with the department or in conjunction with their county board or city council or whoever their local elected officials, I think that just makes more sense.
Now, the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, the state's largest police union, has expressed some skepticism about this. They say that the courts have been vague on this issue of no-knock search warrants and that you're asking departments to sort through the legal issues on their own and put forward a policy is a tall order. What do you have to say to that?
I took the comments as being more support for the idea of the bill than for a valid argument against the bill. I mean, to say that this is an area that has got some thorny legal issues, no doubt it does. That's why officers should be operating with the guidance of having a written policy in their department. And I've heard both sides, from that side on the one extreme saying, boy, no one can do a policy, that would be too tough to do, to the other side of, hey, this is all duplication because most of us have already got a policy. In fact, it would be crazy if you didn't already have a policy. Many of these departments have responded saying, why are you asking us to do this when we've already done it? And I think that illustrates the point that those that have done a policy see how important it is and can't imagine that you wouldn't have one. Those that haven't done a policy look at it as almost too difficult to do, and that might be part of the reason, when really the truth is it's important to have one. It can be done. It should be done.
We're talking with Republican State Representative from Hudson, Dean Knutson, talking about his new legislation introduced aimed at clarifying the use of some police procedures. And let's talk about the second bill here. This one revolves around reporting when and why SWAT teams are dispatched. What's the goal of this one, and why do you think it's needed at this point in time?
Well, again, you know, SWAT teams, special weapons and tactics are an important tool for police. We want our police officers to be safe, and they put themselves in harm's way often. And so, again, this is not about inhibiting their ability to do their job and do it safely, but it is about transparency and letting the public see what's going on. So all we're asking for here is that there be an annual report from each law enforcement agency to the Department of Justice that simply says, here's how many times we activated our SWAT team, the special team. Here's how many arrests were made, whether property was seized, was it a forced entry, was a weapon discharged, any individuals or pets hurt in the raid. And that information would be aggregated at the Department of Justice and made available on their website so that people could see how the use of SWAT teams by the police is happening across the state of Wisconsin.
Representative Knutson, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We've been talking with Dean Knutson, Republican State Representative from Hudson. He joined us to talk about his new legislation aimed at clarifying the use of some police procedures, including the no-knock search warrant and the when and why of SWAT teams.
College football season is in high gear, with the Badgers hosting a non-conference game this Saturday after a 1-1 start.
Our next guest says the immense popularity and the controversy surrounding college football are nothing new. In his book, he traces the rise of college football and the up-and-down story of the first Wisconsin superstar, a kicker named Pat O'Day.
Dave Revson is the studio host for the Big Ten Network and the author of The Opening Kickoff, The Tumultuous Birth of a Football Nation. Dave, welcome to the show.
Oh, my pleasure, Rob. Great to be with you.
When we think about the challenges, Dave, facing college football nowadays, you know, concussions and recruiting scandals, eligibility questions, people might think, hey, it's not like the good old days, right? It was a simpler time. But you write 1890s, 1915, a lot of these problems were there, maybe even worse than now. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that was what was really fascinating to me. I think you keep hearing in these challenging times that college football is in, and it really is kind of it's an interesting dichotomy with college football, because in some ways it's never been healthier than it is right now. I mean, you have the first ever college football playoff championship game wasn't just the highest rated sports program ever on cable. It was the highest rated program ever on cable. So, I mean, the interest is over the top. And yet all these issues that you were alluding to, and people kind of, there is a tendency, and I don't think this is unique to football in any way, but to say kind of, well, why can't we just go back to the way it used to be? And I think I had this notion, too, of the early years of college football being these kind of well-mannered Ivy Leaguers taking a break from reciting Shakespeare to go kick the football around for a couple hours in front of maybe a few hundred interested onlookers. And it just couldn't have been further from the truth. You know, all of the issues that we're grappling with today in college football really manifested themselves in this period, and also the immense popularity started in that period. I mean, I opened the book with a game in 1893 between Princeton and Yale, played in New York City before 50,000 people, which was twice as many as had ever seen a Major League Baseball game at that point. And one newspaper sent 17 reporters to cover that game. So it was a big deal even then, And it had all these challenges even then.
Apart from the downsides, there's a lot of love from the game. Can you set the scene for us here in Wisconsin? What was support like? What were the games like in a Wisconsin football game?
Right. So the impetus for me doing this book was discovering this story for myself of Pat O'Day. And I think a lot of Wisconsin fans probably know a little bit here and there about Pat O'Day. I kind of stumbled upon his story in a really roundabout way and just became completely swept up by it. I just couldn't believe what a superstar he had been. He played at Wisconsin in the late 1890s. He was the first ever All-American at Wisconsin and really was one of the first superstars of our area of the Midwest in college football. Was a player who was known from coast to coast. And Wisconsin won the first two Big Ten championships, 1896 and 97. O'Day was on the 96 team but actually got hurt. He was far and away the best player on the 1897 team and then played two more years at Wisconsin, getting national acclaim. And it was a huge, huge deal in Madison. I mean, the game really took off in the 1890s in the time that he was there. And that's when it took off, you know, throughout the Midwest. I mean, this was the defining period of college football in the country. There had kind of been this diaspora of coaches from the East to the Midwest. Wisconsin was part of that with Phil King, who had been a great player at Princeton, an All-American quarterback who came to coach Wisconsin. There were similar coaches all throughout the what we would now refer to as the Big Ten schools. And the game took off, and people in Madison were completely caught up in it. And that part of it really appealed to me. As someone who covers the Big Ten, obviously I'm the studio host for the Big Ten Network, so I felt like I knew the stories of these schools in and out. But to kind of stumble into this O'Day story and realize there was so much I didn't know, it really sucked me in.
Talking to Dave Revson with the Big Ten Network. He's the author of The Opening Kickoff, The Tumultuous Birth of a Football Nation. Pat O'Day, superstar, he was the kicker. The game was different then. Talk about the kicker as superstar.
Yeah, it is crazy, isn't it, Rob? But, I mean, it's fairly easy to understand. So there are two concepts to grasp. The first one is that a field goal is worth more than a touchdown. So right away you understand the value of a kicker at that point. And that scoring system, and I trace it kind of throughout the course of the book, how the scoring system kind of readjusted through the years in a way that ended up de-emphasizing the kicker and kind of putting them in the place where they are now, or I think they're sometimes kind of scoffed at as a necessary evil in football. But at that time, they were huge stars. There was no substitution, so the kicker would have to play a position. In Pat O'Day's case, he was the fullback on offense, and he was what we would refer to today as the safety, but they called the fullback on defense then too, but the player who played furthest from the line of scrimmage. And he was a great player. He was a phenomenal athlete. In fact, he briefly held a world record in the 300-meter hurdles that he set at a track meet while competing for Wisconsin. So he was a great, great athlete in addition to being this phenomenal kicker. So that was part of it. And then the other thing is there's no forward pass. And so field position was incredibly important. Teams would often punt on first down. So they would get the ball and they'd punt it right back. And so if you had a great kicker, you'd kind of win that battle of field position attrition. You might gain 15 yards on one exchange, 15 yards on another exchange, and then eventually your field position would be so good that you would try to score.
I want to follow Pat O'Day out of his football career. As you say, he was a superstar, nationally known, and then he dropped off the face of the earth. He disappeared.
That was the part that really intrigued me when I read his story. I mean, that was where it went from me to being, wow, this is really interesting, to being, wow, how can I tell this story? What could I do? And, you know, I initially kind of thought, well, maybe we do something with it at BTN, and then I just kind of got into it more and more. Yeah, it's a crazy story. I mean, he was, again, like, just for some people to understand, he was a nationally known star. Everyone across the country knew who he was. When he decided he was going to play his final year, that was a story that was covered in newspapers throughout the country. And so then he kind of is on the fringes of the football world for a while, and then he literally drops off the face of the earth, as far as people know, right around the beginning of World War I. He is indicted for embezzlement in California, where he has moved. A letter is read at that indictment that basically says, you'll never have to deal with me again, the implication being that he's dead. The popular story was that he had been killed in World War I. He was an Australian, which we haven't really touched on, but part of what makes his story so fascinating is he came to the U.S. with no knowledge of our game at all. He was following his brother, who was the crew coach at Wisconsin. The belief was that he had enlisted in the Australian Army and been killed, And then, as you know, Rob, about 15 years later, we learned that that wasn't the story at all. His life just had completely gone off the rails. He disappeared during the time of the indictment and then reappears to incredible acclaim and really a fascinating kind of denouement to his story.
Yeah. As we wrap up, tell us about his return to Wisconsin and his recognition.
Yeah, well, first of all, there were probably few people in the history of the United States who were more fortunate to live before Google than Pat O'Day, because there's not a single mention made of his indictment when he reappears. He reappears, a California newspaper reporter in San Francisco breaks the story of his reappearance. He had been living under an assumed name at a lumber camp in Northern California. He comes back to tremendous acclaim. I mean, it's a huge story in Wisconsin, you know, front page of the Wisconsin State Journal, written about for weeks and weeks. It's incredible that he's been found. Wisconsin invites him back for a homecoming celebration. He comes back. There's a huge celebration, a bonfire with 5,000 people there, and Pat O'Day addressing the audience. He first goes to Chicago, where WGN holds a big gala, and he is the featured speaker there. Then he comes to Milwaukee and then eventually to Madison. He speaks in front of the crowd. He's brought back for the homecoming game against Wisconsin, or against Illinois, I should say, in 34. Illinois nationally ranked. Wisconsin knocks him off. And then from there on in, the rest of his life, Pat O'Day kind of re-enters into popular life. He's Bob Hope picks the All-American team, and Pat O'Day is there on his show to help him out. When he's dying, President Kennedy writes him a letter in the hospital. I mean, he kind of leads the life that you would have thought he would have led after this great superstar career, lives to be 90 years old. So I tell the broader story of college football, kind of weaving Pat O'Day through it and using him as an example, kind of a micro example of all of these bigger forces that were at work in the game, and then kind of conclude by telling his story, which was absolutely bizarre.
Amazing story. Dave, thanks so much for joining us.
Rob, my pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
That was Dave Revson, author of The Opening Kickoff, The Tumultuous Birth of a Football Nation.
Coming up after the news, we'll hear from a guest who's calling for a balanced approach to groundwater management in Wisconsin. When it comes to natural resources in Wisconsin, water is among the most important. We rely on it to drink, to grow our food, and to provide opportunities for recreation.
But our next guest says there are some serious issues facing groundwater here in the state. He's calling on the legislature to take action and come up with solutions that protect and manage the state's groundwater in a fair and comprehensive way.
Joining us now is Mark Redston, president and CEO of Clean Wisconsin. Along with two other environmental activists, he recently wrote an opinion piece calling for a balanced approach to groundwater management in the state. Mark, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for asking me.
So, Mark, in your opinion, what is the state of Wisconsin groundwater here in 2015?
I'm sorry.
The state of Wisconsin groundwater. How would you characterize it?
The state of Wisconsin's groundwater is really threatened right now. I mean, there is, it's hard to imagine that in a state of like Wisconsin, where you have so many lakes, rivers, and streams, that we could actually have an issue of groundwater not being available for drinking or for use. But in some parts of our state, we're really seeing a burden on those resources. In some parts of the state, it's so extreme that rivers and lakes are actually drying up.
Well, paint a picture for us, if you will. If you were to do a scan of Wisconsin, what would you see in terms of some of these concerns that you're just outlining?
Well, if you were to go around Wisconsin, you would see in parts of the state, like primarily the biggest part of the state, Washera County, Marquette County, Central Sands Region, Adams County. There's an area of the state where there is so much use of the groundwater that the lakes and rivers are drying up. So you're seeing, you know, property owners who once bought a house on the edge of a lake with piers that extend hundreds of yards out, and so that they now have a mud front property, and you can even see entire river segments that are dry. In 2013, American Rivers listed the Little Plover River near Stevens Point as one of the most endangered rivers in the country because it runs dry. So these are problems that are not unique to California anymore. These are problems that we're starting to see in our state. And I mentioned the Central Sands region of central Wisconsin, but these issues extend to northwestern Wisconsin, southeastern Wisconsin, western Wisconsin. It's all over the place, and it's going to get even more so unless we can begin to look for a balanced approach to using our groundwater.
It's interesting because here we are in Wisconsin. We're flanked by the Great Lakes on two sides. We've got lakes abundant in northern Wisconsin and peppered throughout the rest of the state. It's hard to imagine that groundwater is not abundant here. What is the disconnect between the perception of the water around us and the resources that we have to use?
Well, we're just using it at an unsustainable level. So there's lots of pressures on our groundwater. We use our groundwater for drinking. 70% of Wisconsinites use groundwater for their drinking supply. We use it for irrigating our fields, and we're just not taking enough care think about how that groundwater resource is affecting the surface water and other uses in Wisconsin, and we're using it at an unsustainable level.
Now, in your recent opinion piece, you say that the problem of available groundwater is at a crisis level in central Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. That's a strong statement. In particular, why a crisis level in central Wisconsin?
Well, over the last 3 years, you've seen a 40% increase in high-capacity wells in that area. It's an area of the state that is where all the surface waters are fed by the groundwater. So a significant overuse of water, which is beginning, it's been there for a while, but it's getting even worse, is starting to have dramatic impacts on the livelihoods of people who live there. So, our current protections, our current laws in Wisconsin don't protect citizens adequately, and they're finding that when they go to the DNR to get some sort of remedy for the problems they're seeing, they don't have any. And so they're having to spend, their personal resources to hire attorneys and to go into a very contentious and costly legal setting. And it's neighbors against neighbors. It's just not a process that's going to yield good results. And so the state of Wisconsin, our leaders, our legislators especially, need to listen and see what's happening in central Wisconsin and respond. Other states have already done so. Both Michigan and Minnesota have a similar situation with lots of agricultural users, lots of drinking water use on their groundwaters and groundwater supply, and they have looked and made a plan to go forward that is sustainable. And the solutions are there. They're not that complicated. It just takes a willingness and a leadership.
Mark Redston is with us right now. He's president and CEO of Clean Wisconsin. He's calling on the state legislature to adopt a balanced approach to groundwater management in the state of Wisconsin. Now, looking at central Wisconsin again, you mentioned high-capacity wells as part of the problem. Let's talk about that for a moment. What is going on with those wells, that there's such a high output of water coming out of these wells, and how long has this been a problem?
Well, what you're seeing is a proliferation of large confined animal units, large factory farms that are starting to happen. I mean, it's a part of the state where you have very sandy soil, so it's good for growing crops, but it's a thirsty soil. It's a sandy soil, so you need to irrigate quite a bit. Because of the conditions of that landscape, there's a lot of people who are interested in being, of using the water resources there and, siting their dairy farm or having a large vegetable farm of some sort. So those conditions are just getting more and more extreme and just need to be managed better.
Now, if you're a farmer at one of those organizations that you mentioned, you're going to say, well, I need this water for my livelihood. This is how I make my money and I need my water. So where's the balance point there?
Well, I think it's you have to look at sound science. So you can't make these decisions to issue a high-capacity well in isolation. They need to be considered in the context of all of the other things that are happening in that region. And, of all of the permits that are issued in Wisconsin, the high-capacity wells are the only ones that never expire. So we issue a high capacity well, and it's a very significant permit that, you know, you need to make sure you get right. These are high volumes of water, and they don't expire. So they're not able, you're not able to review them, except, you know, unless they there's a transfer of ownership, or they need to reconstruct the well or do something of that significance. But if everything is in proper use, they just go on without any sort of review by the Department of Natural Resources. So if you keep putting them in a place where that's in a place where the water supply is already taxed, you're going to have even more problems. So we just need to like look at these individual applications and make good decisions about them. We want to use the resource. We don't want to abuse it.
Well, and earlier this month, a Republican-backed bill was introduced that would allow people to replace, rebuild, or transfer high-capacity wells without state approval.
That's right.
And what do you see as the possible impact of that bill?
Well, I mean, that's not only the status quo, which is unsustainable, that's going backwards, because that's the only time DNR presently has the opportunity to review and make changes to a high-capacity well permit. So to memorialize bad decisions and then not allow any opportunity for review is just a gigantic step backward and is absolutely not sustainable.
Now, proponents of that bill say that if a property changes hands, there's uncertainty there for the person picking up that property, that maybe that permit won't be renewed, and it's a time of uncertainty that doesn't need to be there, and this bill would address that. What do you say to that?
Well, if it's a sustainable well, it should be allowed to be re-permitted. But the problem is that, you know, the common sense solution is just taking a look at what is happening and the cumulative impact of all of these wells. And we have to begin to do that. We can't bury our head in the sand and say that these wells should be issued no matter what. The water of Wisconsin belongs to the people of Wisconsin. And when we withdraw, you know, millions of gallons of water, it has an impact on your neighbor and on the resources around you. So there needs to be consideration, careful consideration of that. Other states make that a very high priority, and
What have other states done?
So there, Minnesota and Michigan, the two state neighboring states, have different strategies. Michigan, for example, has invested in a very robust and ecologically minded online system. So it's very easy and transparent for people who want to get a permit to enter their address and where they would like to get a high capacity well and look and see, is that a red, yellow, or green area for permitting? And that red, yellow, and green information is based on very good information about what's going on in the environment. So they get clarity. The cost of a high-capacity well permit is about $2,000 for your first application in Michigan. Here it's $500. It's four times what it costs in Wisconsin and Michigan. And people are happy because they have a very good system that works, that's transparent, and is protective of the resources. Another example that Michigan does is they have about 20 full-time employees to manage all of their high-capacity well permit applications. Wisconsin, in contrast, has five. So Minnesota has taken a different approach. They don't have an online system, but they make investments in having sufficient resources. They have nearly 60 people, 10 full-time and 50 part-time people to manage their high-capacity well permits. So they're making significant investments and making good decisions at the time a permit is issued. As well, they're making it a high priority to have public access be a consideration in the process and not, you know, excluded from the decision-making process.
We're talking with Mark Redston, president and CEO of Clean Wisconsin. He's calling on the state legislature to adopt a balanced approach to groundwater management here in the state of Wisconsin.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the biggest issue, the biggest concern facing groundwater here in the state? What solutions, what changes, if any, would you like to see? How would you like to see the state's water protected into the future? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're talking with Mark Redston, president and CEO of Clean Wisconsin. He's calling on the state legislature to come up with comprehensive solutions to protect groundwater here in Wisconsin.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you see as the biggest issues facing groundwater in the state, and how would you like to see those addressed? How would you like to see the state's water protected for future generations? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we go to our callers right now. We have Richard joining us first from Wausau. Richard, hi.
Hello.
Hi, what do you think?
Well, with regard to the concern of the adequacy of our fresh water, I think California is faced with some of that to a larger degree, but it was demonstrated or discovered that 70% of the rainwater was running into the ocean. And I think here in Wisconsin, we probably could build more reservoirs to capture that. And secondly, I think we need more innovation than regulation.
All right, Richard, thank you for the call. What about that? Should we be, are we being wasteful and not capturing more rainwater? And what about more innovation instead of regulation?
Well, there's definitely a need for more regulation in this area because the way we're managing our water resources is inadequate, and it's causing significant resource problems. That being said, there is a lot that communities can do and that individuals can do to conserve water where it falls. And we're very active in implementing those policies and programs in urban areas of Milwaukee, for example, where we're helping install rain barrels and rain gardens and trying to keep water where it lands. But there's lots of things that farmers can do to manage this in a more in a comprehensive way, as well as individuals and municipalities. But there's no denying that there is a need to manage this resource more better.
So you'd like to see more regulation to manage the resource, and you gave us a little bit of a look at what other states have done, Minnesota, mm-hmm. for instance. What would you like to see done here in Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, we need to have sufficient staff resources to look at the proliferation of new high-capacity well permits. They've increased by 40% over the last 3 years, and the staffing is only 5. It hasn't increased.
Why 40% in the last 3 years? What's happening?
Demand. There's more agricultural demands, more people coming in wanting to have some of our water, and that's placing a big burden on the people who use the water, all users. So there's definitely the issue of both staff resources and resources to fund the program. As the previous caller mentioned, there's lots of things that we can do for water conservation and to make sure that we're conserving as much water as we can before we pump more out of the ground. We need to take a very broad and comprehensive look at the cumulative impacts of all of the permits and other actions that are going on the landscape. And we need to monitor. We need to monitor more carefully. And one of the things that's been a big source of frustration for us at Clean Wisconsin is that very simple things like monitoring are being challenged in every single permit by those people who are getting their new permits. So, I mean, these are common sense things that everybody should be able to agree with, but we're fighting over them right now.
And who loses out? Who's on the front lines of this if things continue as you say they're going?
Well, if they continue along this path, we're all going to suffer. As I mentioned, 70% of us rely on groundwater for drinking water. We all love to use the Wisconsin lakes, rivers, and streams. I mean, this is a very important part of our cultural tradition here in Wisconsin. And if we begin to see more and more drawdown of our water watersheds, our groundwater, we're going to have problems with the lakes and rivers that we use today. It's a very real economic impact to somebody who lives on a lake that is receding. That if you once had a lakefront property that is now a mudfront property, that's a very big and difficult economic hardship. And if you're having to build a new well or drill for a new well because the water table has dropped so much, these are very real costs that we have to begin to address now, and they're going to get worse and worse for more of us.
We're going to go back to our callers, thanks to Richard. Next up is Les from Adams County. Les, hi.
Hi. Hi, Mark. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just a resident here that's concerned about the long-term impact of these irrigations. I was born and raised on a farm. We didn't irrigate. We had heavier ground. My dad always maintained, he's gone now, but he said God wanted us to grow plants on sand. He made sure there was plenty of water. Now, that contradicts what a lot of people believe nowadays with irrigations. But my concern is twofold. One, which you kind of touched on about the wells and what will happen. It's, a lot of people are very concerned about it and the drawdown on lakes and streams. They maintain here in this county, you know, with all the irrigation farmers, that has no impact. That comes strictly out of the aquifer and that there is no impact. Well, I don't know. I can't say because I'm not qualified to make that. That's where we look to you people. The next thing is I'm very concerned, as a lot of people are in this county, about the fact that the sand has a very limited filtering ability. It isn't what they thought it was 30 years ago.
Unless I'm going to jump in, so make sure we've got some time here for Mark to respond. What about the irrigation, and especially on arid soil, sandy soil?
Well, thanks, Les. I mean, you make some excellent points. And I think the issue of having the resources that you need to, you know, to contradict what's being said about the drawdown is a really big problem. I mean, these are they're putting the burden of proof onto people who don't have the resources to prove it. And organizations like Clean Wisconsin and others are trying to, you know, intervene and help out, but we too have limited resources. So this is a thing that we need to have our state make good investments in. And this is part of the whole staff resources issue. Secondly, on the issue about a filtering that you just started to touch on, what I think you're starting to say is that you're not only having an issue of groundwater quantity problems, but quality issues as well. So things that get spread on the landscape in many parts of our state are more easily getting into the groundwater supply. And we're starting to see really strong evidence of bacteria, nitrates, heavy metals, other places, other things, you know, throughout Wisconsin. So this is becoming not only a water quantity issue, but also a water quality issue.
And that issue that you were talking about, that happens when you're saying irrigate on sandy soil, something that doesn't filter as well?
Well, I think what he's referring to is just that you in some parts of the state where you might have, let's say, a fractured bedrock and you apply manure on the surface and you have just a very thin layer of soil, it's easy for those nutrients to get through the soil, the layer of soil, and through the bedrock into the groundwater supply. And so we're learning more about how things transfer down into the groundwater, and we're starting to see more of that, more concern in that area.
Let's get in one more quick call here. We've got Brandon joining us from Barron County. Brandon, hi.
Hi. The one thing I haven't heard your guest mention, I understand the whole dairy farming. I dairy farm myself. As far as the high capacity wells, the one thing I haven't heard you mention anything about frac sand mining. The concern I have is, if you take a look at the map of this part of the state, northwestern Wisconsin, the amount of frac sands that have high capacity wells have been issued permits in the last 5 or 6 years around this area, not to mention the chemicals that are being used to wash the sand.
Okay, thank you so much, Brandon. And what about frac sand mining and the effects there in the water usage?
Yeah, Brandon makes an excellent point. Not only are we seeing an increase in high-capacity wells for irrigation, we're seeing a huge increase in frac sand mining in our state, especially in western Wisconsin. And he's right. There's a very heavy use of, it's a very water-intensive process, and they use chemicals. And so we are very concerned about it, and that's just yet another pressure on the groundwater supply and on the water quality of our state.
And as we wrap up, Mark, you've got some things that you'd like to see legislation, regulation on. Do you see any of this on the horizon here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, there's as you mentioned, there's one bill that's, I think, moving the state in definitely the wrong direction. That's a bill introduced by Representative Rick Gudex of Fond du Lac and Representative Lee Narrison of Westby. But there's also a bill, Senate Bill 72, that's been introduced by Senator Mark Miller of Monona and Representative Corey Mason of Racine. And that bill will do some of the things that I mentioned earlier, you know, provide adequate resources, make sure we have water conservation, make sure that there is a broad look at cumulative impacts, and we have sufficient monitoring. Now, it's likely that there will be some compromise bill between those two, and State Senator Rob Coles of Green Bay is looking at that language.
Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Mark Redston, president and CEO of Clean Wisconsin. He co-authored a recent opinion piece calling for a balanced approach to groundwater management in Wisconsin.